Blog Talk Radio.
I'm delighted to be back in the United States, my hunting ground of 35 years. The country where I had my innings in the social and economic struggle, and where I decided to devote myself to the presentation of anarchism, a social philosophy which aims at the emancipation, economic, social, political, and spiritual, of the human race.
All right, and welcome to Night of the Authority Smashing Hour. We are one of the only daily anarchist shows on the internet, bringing you a radical perspective on events. Tonight, we will be playing our interview with Derek Jensen and Wazi Atsuin. But first, we're going to do headlines. So I'm joined by Zeno. What's up, Zeno? How's it going?
Hey, pretty good. Just getting all my travel plans, getting ready to head on out to the Left Forum, which will be representing the Authority Smashing Hour.
Yeah, definitely. That should be really exciting. So do you want to start us off with some headlines?
All right. The Ohio State Senate has advanced a measure that would end collective bargaining rights for state employees. On Wednesday, the Republican-controlled chamber approved the legislation on a 17-16 vote. Six Republicans joined with Democrats in opposition. The measure is even more far-reaching than a similar bill in Wisconsin because it would also affect the police officers and firefighters. The vote came one day after some 20,000 people rallied at the state capitol in Columbus to oppose the bill. The Ohio House is expected to approve the measure next week. If enacted, Ohio would become the biggest state so far to curb the rights of public sector unions.
All right, in Wisconsin, Democrats have been threatened with fines. The Senate's for date. So a standoff over Wisconsin's anti-union bill is too intense. On Wednesday, Republicans in the state Senate advanced a proposal to fine Democrats $100 for each day they remain absent to stall the vote. 14 Democrats fled to Illinois last month to deny Republicans quorum. The measure also calls on Wisconsin police to help find and return the Democrats to Madison. The vote came one day after Walker unveiled a budget that would drastically cut education spending and eliminate some 21,000 state jobs. Nice.
Yes, that's pretty bad. And also in an update on Wisconsin there, the Senate in Wisconsin passed a resolution today allowing for the arrest of those 14 Democratic senators. And basically, the Republicans approved the measure by 19-0 vote, and the Democrats must return to the chamber by 4 p.m., which is past in Central Time, or Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, a Republican, will declare them in contempt of the Senate. Democracy. They're claiming that these Democrats that fled are actually violating democracy and destroying representative democracy as we know it.
Well, look, these people in Wisconsin voted in these lunatics, these Republican crazies, so now they have to live with the consequences of this. I mean, it sucks for the people who didn't vote for it, but it just shows you how representative democracy just doesn't work. It's a sham. It doesn't work. So another sign of this is here in Pennsylvania, there are going to be up to 40,000 people cut from low-income insurance programs. So efforts to slash social spending in the name of budget deficits continues across the country. So here in Pennsylvania, where I live, more than 40,000 people have been dropped from a state-subsidized insurance program for the working poor. Newly elected Republican Governor Tom Corbett cut the program Adult Basic, citing a $4 billion budget deficit. The New York Times describes the move as, quote, one of the largest disenrollments in recent memory, end quote. So before it closed, the program had been unable to keep up with massive demand. More than 505,000 people had been on its waiting list for enrollment. And meanwhile, in Washington State, Democratic Governor Christine Gregory has dropped 17,500 adults for a similar state-funded program for the working poor. Also in Arizona, Republican Governor Jan Brewer has proposed eliminating Medicaid coverage for some 250,000 people. So, yeah.
Here we have another example of how this this phony budget crisis that's it's aiding and is part and parcel with this right-wing propaganda of starving the beast, so to speak. Yet, of course, there's plenty of money out there, and the whole point is that it's all about where the politicians choose for the money to go. And ultimately, and as many people have pointed out, is that all they have to do is tax the rich or make the corporations pay their taxes, make the rich pay the maybe 80s or 90s at this point tax rates, given that they're only paying like 35% now. And none of these things, you wouldn't have to fire any of these teachers or close down any of these parks or libraries or any of these things. And it just really shows, what is valuable to the society. And, when we pattern what's important to our society and how it functions after the personality of a sociopath, of course the children, the sick, and the elderly are the first under the bus.
Yep, of course, that's what capitalism is. I mean, it's not surprising. So let's see here. The U.S. inserts – oh, do you want to do this one about the ICC?
Yeah, this is very interesting. There's also this news that Gaddafi's forces launched new airstrikes on towns captured by rebels in the uprisings. And again, it was at Brega and Ajabaya. But also they're saying that, I think this is from Al Jazeera, saying that Gaddafi has accepted an offer from Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez to mediate the crisis. And so far, more than 140,000 people have fled Libya to escape the violence. But of course, we've heard all these calls coming out of our country and in the international institutions of floating ideas of no-fly zones and now taking it to the International Criminal Court. And basically, we've also had Libya expelled from the UN Human Rights Council earlier this week in response to the attacks on civilians. And the Obama administration has now come under criticism for a little notice provision inserted to the measure expelling Libya. The measure calls on the International Criminal Court to look into filing charges against the Gaddafi regime for crimes against humanity. Although the measure marked the first time the United States has supported the ICC at the United Nations, the Obama administration managed to insert a clause that would exempt foreign nationals from international prosecution from any actions committed in Libya under a Security Council mandate. That means that in the event U.S. forces take part in an international force invading Libya, any potential war crimes committed would be tried in a U.S. court, not at The Hague. So there you have it there, folks.
Yeah, the U.S. has already made it clear that we're not going to honor the United Nations Criminal Court. And, we just refuse to take part in that, even though the United Nations is headquartered in New York City. So it just goes to show you how we'll use the United Nations when it suits our purposes, but when it doesn't, we'll disregard it. And when you're a powerful state, you can make that sort of decision. So let's see. The last headline I want to do here has to do with the situation in the Gulf Coast, which has received really no coverage at all. It's like the oil spill never happened. Everything's back to normal. But actually, it says here that high manatee and dolphin deaths are puzzling U.S. officials. Apparently, near record numbers of manatees and dolphins have died in Florida waters in early 2011. This is the second straight year of above average deaths. says there have been about 163 manatee deaths since January 1st, and this is highly irregular. They're blaming this on cold water off the coast of the state. And they're saying that it's too soon to blame these deaths on the oil spill, and that we can't really be sure what the cause is, and, you know, this type of stuff. And also, yeah. And at the same time, the Obama administration has begun issuing deep water drilling permits in the Gulf. So we're setting ourselves up for another disaster. It's just really unbelievable. So let's see. We have some radical history items here. Do you want to start us off with that?
All right. Today in radical history for March 3rd, on this date in 1657, in the New World, blacks and Native Americans rebel in Massachusetts.
And in 1756, in England, the British philosopher slash anarchist William Godwin is born in Wisbeck, Isle of, oh, I can't even pronounce that, sorry. So his best known work is an inquiry concerning the principles of political justice. The first modern anarchist writer and friend of William Blake and Thomas Paine. He was also the spouse of Mary Wollstonecraft and father of Mary Shelley, the writer, the author of Frankenstein.
And her husband was also Percy Shelley. So that's a pretty interesting family tree there.
Mm-hmm.
And in 1871, in the U.S., the Senate decides it will no longer contract treaties with Indian nations. Congress calls all Native Americans wards of the state, nullifying all treaties. And also in a similar act in 1875, this illegal act of Congress removes lands from Oregon Coast Reservation, despite opposition by Coos and other tribes. Alesia Reservation, Oregon, is returned to public domain.
In 1953 in Guatemala, Jacobo Arbenz declares the nationalization of idle lands held by the United Fruit Company. U.S.-backed terrorism and genocide under the catchphrase defending freedom and democracy follow for the next 30 years.
And our last piece, I think I'll throw it to you. It's a good one and fitting with the interview that I think you should set up.
Yeah, I'm trying to read this here. It says on this date in 2020, was this like a satire or something like that?
Yeah.
Okay, so I guess by the date of 2020, humans will have caused 150 species to be extinct on this day alone. So we're pretty much heading in that direction, it seems. So, we're going to play an interview of Derek Jensen and Wazi Asselin. It was a very interesting interview. We recorded it yesterday. So, but first I want to say thanks to Rabble Rouser, a.k.a. Mike from Burn, Bottom Up Radio Network. I think his show has gone offline for a while, but I hope he'll bring it back. He's the one that actually introduced me to Wazi Asselin. I heard him interview her early last year. So, yeah, thanks, Mike, for that great interview. And I'm going to play a song from his group, Holy, Holy, Holy. And after that, we're going to play the interview with Derek Jensen and Wazi Asselin.
Anyway. Okay, tonight we're joined by two special guests. Our first guest is Wazi Atsewing. She is an activist, teacher, and a writer. One of her last books is called What Does Justice Look Like? She has her PhD in history from Cornell University, and she currently holds the Indigenous Peoples Research Chair at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. She is also the founder and director of a nonprofit organization focusing on Dakota liberation and sustainable ways of being. You can find all of her information at waziatsween.net. Waz, thanks for being here with us.
Hi, Ron. Thank you for having me.
Hey, and our second guest is Derek Jensen. He is an activist, philosopher, and author. His books include Endgame Volume 1 and Endgame Volume 2, and also Mischief in the Forest. He has won numerous awards, and he speaks very often at many different venues around the country. You can find all of his information at derekjensen.org. Hey, Derek, thanks for being here with us tonight.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, so the first thing I want to talk about is deep green resistance. But before we actually get to the conversation, I just, you know, have an anecdote that will hopefully link it all together. You know, here in Philadelphia, where I live, there's a store called Whole Foods. And are you both familiar with this, Whole Foods, the chain of stores?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was there basically because they have this cod liver oil that you can't really find anywhere else. But, like, I hate going to this place because it really is such a personification of this green capitalism and, you know, these kind of false solutions that we've been handed. And whenever you go there, you see, you know, the typical, you know, smug-faced hipsters, and everyone kind of has this air of like self-congratulation, like, look, we're doing so much to help the environment or whatever. And but meanwhile, like, while everyone is shopping at Whole Foods, there's things like this happening. And this is actually happening in Pennsylvania, not too far from where I am. A story just came out today about untreated radioactive wastewater being dumped from these hydrofracking facilities into the groundwater, into streams, into lakes and rivers. And the EPA has known about this for years, but they allow it to continue. And basically, it's radioactive water that is basically, you know, in people's drinking water. And this is happening not too far from me. And, you know, while we're being given these false solutions, we have this whole systemic problem of capitalism basically just destroying everything. And I was wondering if we could start off by talking about how deep green resistance and deep ecology differs from, you know, the green capitalism that we're being handed by the mainstream media and by the typical liberal establishment.
Well, do you want to go first, Waz, or do you want me to go first?
Why don't you go first?
Okay. Well, I think that the entire environmental movement, such as it has been co-opted into lifestyleism and personal solutions. And I think that there are reasons for this, and one of those reasons is that it focuses attention away from where it should be, which is on institutional power and on the fact that there are institutions that are destroying the planet. And a really good example of this, it happens all the time, and a great example, Stephanie McMillan and I wrote a book called Ezra World Burns, 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Stay in Denial. And I wanted to base that on the, you know, all those books, 50 Simple Things You Can Do to Save the Earth, et cetera, et cetera. And that was all, the idea for the book came when we saw Al Gore's movie. And in this movie, the same thing happens. It happens so often, which is they lay out the problems pretty clearly, and then their solutions are always, I mean, he lays out the global warming. It's a very, very, very bad thing. It's very, very dangerous. And then the solutions are things like change your light bulbs and inflate your tires. And that's sort of classic prestidigitation. You know, it's sleight of hand. It's sleight of mind. Let's focus the attention in the wrong place, because Al Gore did not talk about corporate power. He didn't talk about capitalism. He didn't talk about a growth economy. He didn't talk about civilization. And we see this all the time. And I guess one more direction I want to go with this, two more directions I want to go with this, is that one of them is Robert J. Lipton wrote this great book called The Nazi Doctors. And in this book, he asked the question, how is it that people who take a Hippocratic Oath could work in Nazi death camps? And what he found is that many of the doctors actually cared very deeply for the health of the inmates, and they would do whatever they could to help the inmates at the concentration camps, except for the most important thing of all, which is they wouldn't question the existence of the death camp itself, and they wouldn't question the existence of the entire, you know, racist, oppressive, fascist regime. And environmentalists do the same thing all the time, which is we'll do whatever we can to protect this or that piece of ground, everything except the most important thing of all, which is to question the entire culture that's turning the planet into first a work camp and then a death camp. And still two more things. One of them is that, you know, you said the EPA has known about this and isn't really regulating. One of the things that we have to really understand is that these regulatory agencies are not set up to actually protect people. They're set up to provide a layer of to provide a buffer between outrage at the routine murder of people and land bases and those who are doing the murder. It's like, well, wait a second, why you know, I don't need to do anything about it because the EPA is going to take care of it.
Mm-hmm,
but it's the same people are – the same people come up with the permitting processes who then benefit by the permitting processes and who – and are the same people being permitted. It'd be like, you know, a drug dealer who is also the police, who is also the person who is setting up the laws having to do with drugs, except that, of course, fracking will kill a lot more people than drugs will. So that's really, I mean, one of the first things, and this all has to do with identity, and do you identify more clearly with the system, with the capitalists, with capitalism? It's like all the so-called solutions of global warming all have the same thing, have one thing in common, which is they take industrial capitalism as a given and the land as that which must conform to industrial capitalism, the earth as that which must conform to industrial capitalism. And this is a classic thing of abusers of all time, is that the abusive system is that which must not be questioned. And so I know that I'm throwing a lot of things out, and I'm going to turn it over to Waz and hope she can tie them all together.
Thanks, Derek. Well, I think I'll pick up on the whole identity issue. I'm glad you mentioned that because it's the same thing, I think, in the context of indigenous populations. And so I want to take a few minutes to talk about how this same idea plays out in indigenous communities today. And I think much of it has to do with issues of identity and the way that colonizing societies work to systematically fracture our identity. And so we start to see things in, we've learned to compartmentalize our lives and all aspects of our lives. And so when I think about how our people today oftentimes want to focus on one aspect of who we are and practice that. And the revival of our culture, for example, is extraordinarily important. We need people to be telling stories, to be puffing on songs, to be engaging in traditional planting activities, for example. But we also need that tied to a larger awareness of what's happening to our homelands, what's happening to the water, what's happening to the air. And I think that we've learned to disconnect ourselves from those happenings. And I don't want to say all of us, because I know that there are people who continue to carry on resistance activities every single day. But I also know an awful lot of indigenous people who might have a critique of the society or might be upset at environmental destruction or deterioration, but they don't necessarily feel like it's their responsibility, or we don't feel like it's our responsibility to address those larger issues. And I think that this is where some of those who are concerned about the problems that we see across all lines, there are some very real similarities or commonalities, and that's that the magnitude of the problem seems so great that people do compartmentalize and they do decide that their identity, or they're going to focus their identity, or they see themselves in a particular way that doesn't necessarily involve resistance or in fundamentally challenging the destruction of our homelands in any meaningful way, because the consequences are perceived as too great. So
right.
I just see a lot of those similarities.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think one of the tenets of deep ecology is this concept of self-realization and connecting that to resistance. And I do agree that the dominant culture, or, you know, mainstream culture, it does so much to try to disconnect us from, you know, our true selves and to disconnect us from, you know, indigenous cultures. Or, like, for me, for example, as a Black person here in the United States, I don't have really a culture of my own because it was taken from us, you know, so many years ago. So I really do understand that part of it. And, you know, moving on, but still connected with this is, okay, we kind of talked a little bit about the problems, you know, why we need to be resisting. But I just wanted to ask you both, you know, you're both very much involved in activism. And Waz recently, you were brought under the scrutiny of the FBI because of some of a talk you gave at a university last year. And I wanted to ask you both if, you know, how far are you willing to go? I mean, are you both prepared mentally for the prospect of perhaps coming under the scrutiny of the national security apparatus? Because we all know that when the shit starts to really hit the fan, the mask is going to come off of the system, and they're really going to start cracking down on activists, and they're really going to start showing their, you know, more of their true face. And have both of you thought about things like prison or things, you know, or worse things? Has this come into your thinking process, and how do you deal with this? I mean, is it like just an abstract thing, or do you actually feel that it could become a concrete reality, not just for you, but for other activists in this country here, in the United States and Canada?
Why don't you go first, Waz?
It's fine. I think it's clear probably that both of us are already under scrutiny, and that, you know, we have to act accordingly. From my perspective, I think that it's, you know, even when I look at the recent activity with the FBI, the reason I was under investigation is simply because of something I said, not because I was out there taking action around a particular event or issue, but because I was talking about the right of Dakota people to reclaim our homeland by any means necessary. And just that act of striving towards justice under colonial rule means that we're going to be bumping up against the state, and there are going to be repercussions for that, whether it's death, whether it's imprisonment or harassment. You know, I think that's something that everyone who speaks out in the name of justice has to be aware of. In my case, you know, and I don't think anybody wants to go to jail. I don't think anyone wants to be killed. But I also feel like the situation is dire enough now that if it requires me to give up my life in some capacity, then that's, I have to be real about that, then that's a possibility, and it's a risk I'm willing to take.
Right, Derek?
I think that part of being a serious resistance movement is recognizing that there will be casualties, and that can include any of us, and I think a lot about what I've read of several Black Panther Party members who, just a second,
come here, get up here, come on.
I'm sitting outside with one dog and two puppies, and they need to be reminded of where they're supposed to be. But there's a whole wide world I want to explore. what a lot of the Black Panthers said is that they knew that when they joined, they were either going to end up dead or in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what
the
system does when it is seriously called into question. And I think that we all have decisions that we need to make, and we need to be very serious about this, and we need to think about this before we get started at all. I think about, you know, a lot of the members of the Green Scare, some of them I have tremendous respect for, and there are also some who turned and started cooperating with the feds. One of them within about 15 seconds of being put into a cop car. And what that says to me... Yeah, literally, the guy was like Stan Meyerhoff. He was arrested, and he's sitting in the back saying, okay, you want to talk? And that suggests to me that many things, one of which is that they should never have been participating in those activities in the first place, because the time to have those second thoughts is before you start. And
right. There's
nothing wrong with being entirely above ground. And in fact, only 2% of the IRA, even the IRA, not the Irish population, the IRA, only 2% of the IRA ever picked up weapons. You know, 98% was doing support work. But then the important thing to realize about that, too, is not picking up weapons does not protect you. As regimes become increasingly fascist, the first ones that they target are usually the public intellectuals. This actually just happened in Iraq last week.
Yeah, I was going to say it's happening in Iraq now.
Yeah, 300. Was it 300 public intellectuals were arrested?
Yeah.
Interned, you know, whatever word we want to use. Targeted, you know. And that's part of what happened. That's why Eduardo Galeano spent some of his life in exile, you know. So I think that we need to, we as a movement need to have our seriousness called into question. And this takes us back to Whole Foods, is that, you know, it's really easy and it's pretty safe to recycle or to buy, you know, cool green products. But I think if we put it into a different context, we would recognize that buying cool green products or composting or riding a bicycle would not have stopped the Nazis. And it would not have stopped the Soviets. And it would not have stopped any oppressive regime. And it won't stop capitalism. And, you know, that's time for us to sit back and take a real deep breath. And, you know, I just learned a couple days ago that the blunt-nosed sea snake was the most common sea snake that was seen off the coast of Australia in the 1990s, and they haven't been seen since 2000. I've mentioned before that there used to be frogs so loud you couldn't have a human conversation outside at night, and now there are no frogs. I've heard two Pacific tree frogs this spring, and they should be so loud that you can't speak outside in the evening. And everything is going fast. And like you said, they're pumping uranium into the radioactive water into the groundwater. I mean, how insane does it have to be before we recognize that the system is not redeemable? And I mean, the latest things on global warming are that, you know, of course, every study that comes out is that it's much worse than previously feared. What a surprise. And the latest ones are that it could be up to a 30-degree increase by 2100. That's 89 years from now.
Jeez.
That means that the people who are born now, there are people living now who are going to die horribly in what some are calling the climate holocaust. And and you know, what are they going to do if we make them really mad? Kill the planet twice? I mean, I don't. There's a line in a novel that I wrote that is one of my favorite lines I've ever written, which is this one guy says to somebody else, "Fear is the belief that you have something left to lose." And I think, you know, we do have a lot to lose. I really like my life, and I like, you know, standing here looking at the forest and watching the dog and the two puppies, and, you know, I'm going to go in later and take care of my mom and take her up to do a medical treatment, which I wish I didn't have to do. But, you know, I like my life, and I like living in this beautiful forest, but that doesn't alter the fact that when the world's being killed, what do we really have left to lose?
Yeah, this is definitely a good point, and I agree that we're at a moment in history right now where no matter where you are in your activism, you know, we have to start really thinking seriously about what we're willing to give up and what we're willing to lose. And
sorry about
It's okay. So I just want to ask you both also, like, kind of connected to that, like, we've just talked just now about what the consequences could be for being involved in this sort of activism. And I think, you know, I've thought about that, and obviously you both have thought about that. But
oh, wait, I'll say one more thing, which is right now, I just read this today, what is it, 240, 640, 440, some number of students in Libya were just kidnapped by the governmental forces today. And
mm-hmm.
that doesn't mean that they were doing anything. I mean,
in Libya.
Where was this?
In Libya.
Yeah.
Okay.
And my point is that doesn't mean that those particular people even picked up arms. And my point is that your pacifism, ultimately one's pacifism won't save one anyway. Anyway, sorry,
right.
Go ahead.
Right. No, I totally agree. Go ahead, Waz.
Yeah, I just want to add to that, too, because I think that there also is a distinction between actions that people take that do nothing to challenge the state or to challenge the systems and institutions, and those who do in some way challenge the state and institutions. And I don't mean necessarily by going along with them or working within them. I mean by challenging their fundamental structure. And anytime you engage in that, whether it's some kind of violent engagement or even resisting it in a nonviolent way, you're going to be a threat. There's going to be some kind of risk involved. And I think the question for everyone is that, you know, why, even if people don't want to take up arms, what are they doing to challenge the state? And I think all of us have an obligation to think about that in our lives today, and we all need to begin to risk something because the consequences of not taking action are way too great.
Yes, this is definitely true, and I think everyone listening to this can understand that we're at a moment in time right now that, you know, we're at the edge of a cliff. I mean, we can see what's happening in the Middle East with the oil. Derek just mentioned the students, the hundreds of students who were rounded up in Libya. I hadn't heard about that, but I have been keeping an eye on what's going on over there. And it's just unbelievable. The oil prices are skyrocketing. Germany and Italy and France are going to be sending battleships off the coast of Libya. The situation internationally and, of course, here at home is really to the point where people have to start asking themselves, you know, what is more important, you know, my comfort and my relative privilege or the future, you know, of our society. And I wanted to ask you both, what motivates you and what inspires you to continue with your activism, knowing that the end might be unpleasant? You know, what motivates you and what inspires you to just keep on going?
Well, I think for me, it's the possibility of liberation that, and I may have mentioned this when we talked last time, Ron, but for me, what I see is the convergence of all of these factors, which I think will really allow for the rebirth of indigenous life. And so when I talk to indigenous peoples from all over, there isn't the same sense of fear necessarily about these coming changes. It's about the final liberation of our lands, of our homelands, and of our people.
Mm-hmm.
And that we see as in a very positive light. And we know it's going to be a struggle to get there. But I think even being in the place where we can imagine a different future, we can imagine it happening even within our lifetimes, provides incredible inspiration. It's very different than what my ancestors experienced, you know, just 150 years ago when we went to war against the United States government, against this colonizing, exploitative, violent country and its citizens. And at that time, it was on the rise of American empire. And what we see is that we're on the cusp of collapse now. And I think that allows incredible possibilities and an incredible sense of hope that we finally might be at a place where this way of life is coming to an end.
Derek?
I totally agree with all that. That there's a – David Brower said that one of the problems in the environmental movement is that all of our victories are temporary and our losses are permanent. But I think that given the collapse, the ongoing collapse of the global economy and peak oil and also the collapse of the biosphere, unfortunately, that we're at a point where our victories can be permanent, where if we're able to stop somebody from destroying some piece of ground. This happened in the neighborhood where I live, where and it's only 20 acres, but it's 20 acres still standing, that this developer wanted to destroy these 20 acres, and we in the neighborhood got together and we did everything we could, you know, to stop him. We filed lawsuit, everything we could within the system. We filed a lawsuit, we, you know, all his permits, we fought the permitting process, and we were able to stop him, but the truth is we were able to delay him, and then the housing market collapsed in 2008, and his house went up for back taxes, as did the houses of a couple other people associated with his project, and so the economy made it. Honestly, had we been doing what we did, and then the housing market would not have collapsed, we would have stopped him, and he would have just sold to a buddy who would have just done the same thing. But now the trees are still standing. They may still be standing forever because of this. And we're at a place where that can happen. And the question of what motivates me is I love the land where I live, and I love salmon, and I love migratory songbirds. And 200 species went extinct today, and they were my brothers and sisters. And what do you do if somebody's killing your brothers and sisters? You try to stop them. No, you don't try to stop them. You stop them. And also what motivates me is, I love my own life, and I love myself, and I was raised to do the right thing. Another thing that motivates me, and this is why I'm saying this, honestly, is because I hate the destructiveness, and I hate those who are doing the destroying, and they need to be stopped. I hate the sociopaths.
Yeah,
I have no problem. Some people get, especially white people, sometimes get really upset when I say that I think that hate is a fine and righteous feeling when you're hating someone who deserves to be hated, but it's to be said.
Right. Yeah,
I agree with that, except an oppressor.
Right. Waz, do you want to add anything to that, or?
No, I totally agree.
Yeah, I agree with that too. And I was brought up here in the city, so it's not really that much country. But we luckily here in Philadelphia, there is the largest inner city park in the world. So even though I was growing up in sort of the ghetto kind of rundown area, not too far from my house was this beautiful park. And my whole time growing up, this was like my refuge. And so the older I've gotten and the more I've been learning about the green movement and environmentalism, I've always been reaching back to those experiences to help, guide me and, and just give me a focus. And I think for a lot of people in our society, they have been so disconnected from nature and from the life cycle. And I was wondering, how can we get that back? I mean, how can people start to get back in touch with, what has been sustaining us for, millions of years, but now we're living in this industrial civilization that makes us think that we don't need nature and that we don't need, plants and animals, we can just do without it. I mean, how can we reconnect with that?
I think that the first thing I think of when you say that is what John Livingston said about how people often think of cities as places of sensory overload, but the truth is they're places of sensory deprivation, because every perception that you have is mediated or created by humans. And so you can start to believe that humans are the only ones who matter, and you can start to hallucinate like you do in any sort of echo chamber. And so he believes that our ideologies are, he believed, he's dead, that our ideologies are hallucinations. The belief that Wall Street is important, that industrial capitalism is more important than life. I mean, that's a huge hallucination. It's absolutely insane. And we all deal with that every day. I mean, how many machines do you have a daily relationship with? You know, I got a computer, I got a car, I got a telephone, and how many wild beings of any sort do you have a daily relationship with? And likewise, you know, I am ashamed to admit, but it's true, that my fingers touch plastic more than they touch human flesh.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty sad. But I think it's also pretty typical. Right now I'm holding a phone, you know? And and we can come to believe such that, like, there's this guy, Kevin Kelly, wrote this, he's founder of Wired or whatever. He wrote this terrible book called What Technology Wants. And it's like, yeah, I know what technology wants. It wants to kill us all, but that's not his idea. What technology wants is goodness, he says, which is just
what?
Crazy. And he interviewed me for this book, and it was one of the most surreal experiences of my life. It was absolutely extraordinary. You know, he's saying, so what do you want? You know, you clearly don't want civilization. What do you want? And I said, well, he said, what do you want after civilization crashes? I said, well, wild salmon, lampreys. He said, what else? And I said, migratory songbirds, bats. He said, what else? I said, trees. He said, what else? I said, I don't know, clean water, clean air. What do you want? He said, well, what about cardboard?
Oh, my God. Oh,
I said,
God.
Cardboard? Are you kidding? He said, no, what about cardboard? And what about electricity? I was like, look, most of the people in the world don't have electricity right now, and they survive just fine. I mean, the industrially produced electricity is not sustainable. And, you know, here's the real problem. It doesn't really matter what we want. The important thing is what's possible, you know? And we can all want to have pink ponies for Christmas, you know? And we may want for unicorns to jump over the moon and fart pixie dust. Doesn't fucking matter, you know?
Right.
What's important, yes, it does matter what we want, that I want to live in a world with more wild salmon. I don't want to live in a world with more machines. And that's important. But the truth is, actually, what's most important is what's real. And now I've entirely forgotten the question, so you might have to restate it again for Waz, unless she's forgotten, unless she remembers it.
Well, it was in relation to the city and what people
right.
can do to
we,
kind of reconnect. And, you know, I
think we I want to say one more thing, sorry, which is I think we reconnect just by going outside and by staying outside and by establishing long-term relationships and by defending them. You know, you can't just walk through a forest in your jack boots and pretend that you're a good Nazi.
Right.
What are you actually doing to, you know, what is this tree right here get out of the relationship with me? You know, yes, I can. It's important for me to connect to this tree, to listen to it, to speak to it, to touch it. That's all really important. But at the same time, what am I actually doing tangibly to help this tree? And sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, it's about fostering relationships, a good relationship with all of creation, with all the beings around you. And if you're insulated from those beings, then I think the first step is redeveloping a relationship. I think in the city it's really hard. You know, I'm glad there's a lot of green space there, and it's important to spend time there. I think that because I hate cities so much, I would say leave the city, or work to dismantle within. You know, tear up concrete, tear up sidewalks, tear up what you can, and you know, liberate, help to liberate the land so that life can grow, so that there, you know, that there's something living in that place instead.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, because in any place inside of the city, any city I've been to, you know, you get this feeling of depression and just feeling oppressed just whenever you're surrounded by these concrete and steel buildings. And for me, at least, just not a pleasant feeling. So I want to talk for a moment.
I'll ask you one more thing about that, which is, and I love what you just said, Waz, and what you said too. I totally agree about the cities being really oppressive. And I wrote an anti-zoo book, and in there, one of the arguments made for zoos is that well, people need to connect to wild animals, and that's really, really true. But connecting to animals in a zoo,
we'll imprison them, yeah.
Really, I mean, that's just imprisoning them. And also what you're learning is that the animal, that a wolverine is not the wolverine and the forest, but instead the wolverine is a Wolverine in a concrete pad, and that's not a Wolverine. And what I say in the book is, yes, if you want to connect to nature, I did this little experiment, which is I went to the most nature-dead place in town here, which was a choice between the Walmart parking lot and the McDonald's parking lot.
Ugh.
I went to the McDonald's parking lot, and I got out of the car, and I just sat. And it only took me about 10 seconds to see flies and seagulls, and including a one-legged seagull, but I still remember, and to feel the wind. And 2 points with this. One of them is that even in the city, life still exists. And I think that we need to – it's not the same life as out of the city, but I think that that life, those who live – the non-humans who live in a city are just as sacred and just as important. And I need to just say that in terms of valuing them too. And then the other part is that instead of pretending that you can go to a zoo and talk to a six-year-old and say, see, look, there's a grizzly bear who's walking in circles because it's been driven insane. Instead, what you should do is say to the child, we can't see grizzly bears because of how we're living. And you should be honest and say, there aren't big animals here because we're living in such a way that destroys them. And I think that it needs to start with that level of honesty.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, definitely. Yeah, I definitely agree with that, because we don't tell children the real story. You know, we feed them these fairy tales, so, definitely. So that's part of the most important thing, is to just tell kids the truth. So I want to try to connect what we've been talking about to another strategy for defeating the system. And I think it might rub some radicals the wrong way, because I'm going to talk a little bit about atheism and how atheism is perhaps not this great thing that some people think it is. You know, I'm agnostic, so I think that's a form of atheism, I'm pretty sure. But, you know, a lot of us have thrown off Christianity because we all know that Christianity is just total lunacy and insanity. But I think we've swung the pendulum in the opposite direction way too far, and also saying that, you know, the world is totally demystified. There are no spirits. There are no nothing. Only thing that's real is what you can physically touch, and that's all that matters. And I was wondering what your opinions on this could be. I think, Derek, I've heard you mention before that you are not an atheist. I'm not sure what your religion is, and Waz, I'm not sure exactly what your religion is, but I was wondering your feelings about atheism in connection to industrial civilization, because I'm pretty sure that atheism took off around the same time as the Industrial Revolution, and I'm wondering if you see any kind of connection between that, and is atheism something that we should reconsider or try to redefine, do you think?
Well, okay. You know, when I think about spirituality, I think, you know, what is it at its core? And I think it's a recognition of the spiritual essence of all beings, and that, you know, spirituality from my perspective is really about how we as one aspect of creation work to maintain, foster, facilitate those positive relations with all of the beings around us, and or all of the beings that we are connected to, and I think that we can call them wherever we are. But so what I would say then is I think that when you have that perspective, that you really value the sacredness of life, and you, when you treat other beings as, you know, recognizing their spiritual essence, recognizing their connection to you, it's a much more positive experience than if you treat them as if they're dead, or as if they have no life, or no spiritual essence. It requires a particular way of interacting.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, this, when we talk of spirituality, we talk about or the spiritual essence of all beings. We talk about a consciousness, even with beings that don't have brains, for example, that I think a lot of people in the society would deny a spiritual essence. And so, for example, even rocks, you know, there's no identifiable brain, there's no identifiable movement, yet we know within Dakota society that there is a spiritual essence with all rocks, with all stones, and that the beings there also have the capacity to think. They're conscious. They make decisions. They have personalities. They have they're beings we need to interact with in a respectful way. And if we do that, then it really is a reciprocal relationship that we have, where we take care of them and they also help us in various ways. They can move. They can do things that are not explainable in Western culture. And I think it's that you know, I mean, I can't really say, you know, it's wrong for anybody to be an atheist. I think that it means that there's a different relationship with creation.
Mm-hmm.
And one that runs the risk of devaluing other spiritual beings because you can't recognize all that they are.
Derek?
Yeah, a few things. One of them is, I would bet that stones, if we were to listen to them properly, could probably give us some really good conflict resolution methods, because you're stuck next to this other stone for 6 million years. It's like, I don't like this other stone, but we got to get along because, you know, until the water comes along and carries us away. I thought about that with trees, too. You know, if a tree lives 1,000 years and you don't like your neighbor, you can't just walk away. So they have to come up with really good conflict resolution methods.
Right.
And I'm kind of making a joke, but I'm really not. I think that those are some of the things we can learn. And okay, so now materialism, the belief that there is nothing except matter. That arose at 3 points in history and geography, and not surprisingly, they are the 3 centers of great civilizations, China, India, and Greece. And they arose about the same time. And it's no surprise that those beliefs arose at the same time as those civilizations, when, like Stanley Diamond wrote, civilization originates in conquest abroad and repression at home. Because one of the central parts of exploiting others is silencing their voices. And how better to silence their voices than to pretend they simply don't exist? And, atheism, it seems pretty clear to me, in sort of the scientific, rationalistic thought. I think I call it something like the cult of the scientific materialist managerial mechanistic perspective. I think that science is really the intellectual heir to Christianity, because Christianity, monotheism in general, I'm including Judaism and Islam, all the monotheisms, they did the heavy lifting. And what I mean by that is they were able to remove all meaning from the earth and put it in a distant sky god. And that's really the hard part. And once you've removed all meaning from the earth and from, you know, this tree and that stone and this river, once you've removed all meaning from them, it's really easy to just turn out the light, you know, way out there. And you're absolutely right. It's no surprise that the Industrial Revolution and atheism went hand in hand. At this point, our very epistemology is based on domination. Richard Dawkins says that science, a direct quote, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command. Science bases its claims to truth on making matter and energy. Science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command. And what that means is that they're actually defining truth as the ability to dominate, to enslave. That's an extraordinary statement, and it's so extraordinary, it's so deeply held in this culture that I've said this to people, and they're like, Yeah, of course. That's what science is. So what's the big deal? That's how you know if something's true, is if you can make, you know, if you can make a fact. But I'll tell you a much more interesting and much, I think, much better way to tell if something is true, which is the Tolowa Indians lived where I live now for 12,500 years, and I believe that you can tell that a way of life is true if you can live in one place with it for 12,500 years without destroying the place. I think that's a much different definition of truth. And let's look at this another way. But let's say that I put a gun to your head and I say, you've got to jump through a hoop, and you jump through a hoop. It's like, wow, well, you know, I'm a genius, you know? I predicted you're going to jump through a hoop, and you did. But when I put that gun to your head, I destroyed any possibility of future friendship, and I destroyed any possibility of the sorts of interactions that you and I could enter into that would be, I destroyed many other forms of knowledge that I could have gained. Yeah, there's one form of knowledge. I can, and I'm looking at this tree and I'm saying, I'm not going to do this, don't worry, don't feel bad, but I could cut down this tree and I could sell it, and then I could take that money and buy something else. And that's one form of truth. I could do that. But that would foreclose all other forms of relating to that tree. And one of the problems with science and with the whole dominant culture is it has systematically foreclosed all those other forms of knowing. And there's this line that I was reading this book on, I don't know how to say it, V-O-U-D-O-U-N, Vudan, Voodoo. I was reading this book on Vudan a couple years ago, and there was this line that just slapped me in the face. It was so good. It was the spirits do not compel. This isn't the exact line, but it's basically the spirits influence, they do not compel. And I was thinking how different that is, and that how different that is than the notion of a Christian God or of Richard Dawkins, you know, scientific God. It's a whole entire different. This is just, I'm just validating just what Waz said, really, with it's an entirely different way of relating to the world, where you want to influence, but not, you don't compel, you don't enslave.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense, Waz?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I totally understand what you mean, and I do feel that regardless of whether or not anything is going to come to our aid to help us in our fight, you know, against civilization and against the industrial, you know, death machine that we're surrounded by, I do believe that believing in or acknowledging the existence of, you know, other energies or forces is definitely something that we should be doing more of, and not just looking at the world as this, like you said earlier, Derek, like a dead thing or something that's been totally turned into an object with no essence. So I could go on about this forever, but unfortunately we're running low on time. So I just want to ask you both if there are any projects or books or anything coming up that you want to plug real fast.
I would just say, you know, encourage people to follow what's going on and to really come to terms with the idea that this way of life is, well, we're seeing the absolute destructiveness of it in terms of the global climate change, what that means for all life on the planet and the interconnectedness of all of the happenings right now. Pay attention and prepare and work to work to help facilitate this breakdown. I mean, we have to find a different way of living here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think one of the necessary steps in finding different ways to live is to recognize that this way of living, we need to get rid of the psychopath in the room. You know, industrial capitalism is a psychopath that's killing everyone and everything, and we need to stop that. And I just also want to mention one other thing that is really important, especially for it's so interesting. I can't say us white people because I'm the only white person.
How refreshing.
Anyway, I think that it's very important for me to recognize that I am living on stolen land. And I think that's something that has to be part of the conversation always, is that no matter if this theft was 500 years ago or 3,000 years ago, this culture is based on theft. And we cannot allow the dominant culture, simply because it's been claiming this land for a long time, to claim some sort of moral high ground with it. The theft is still theft. And I'm including this theft from indigenous humans, and I'm including this theft from indigenous non-humans. You know, the land was stolen from the bison, and the land here was stolen from the salmon. And that is a fundamental injustice that needs to be rectified.
Definitely, definitely. So, Derek, Jensen, and Waz, I want to thank you both very much for joining me today. It's been a very, very interesting conversation, and I hope that we can do it again sometime. It was very, very awesome.
Sounds good.
Yeah,
thanks,
thank
Ron.
You.
Thanks, Derek.
All right. That was our interview with Derek Jensen and Wazi Atsuin. And I want to remind everyone that if you would like to hear more of their material or check out their books or essays, you can find Wazi Atsuin's website at waziatsuin.net. She has a lot of interesting material on there. And Derek Jensen's website is derekjensen.org. I think they were too gracious. They didn't want to plug their material, but I do really, really suggest checking out their stuff because it's very thought-provoking. I think Zeno's on the line. Zeno, are you there?
Yes. That was a very interesting interview, and I was glad that there clearly wasn't too much technical problems. It seems Waz is cursed whenever she appears on our show, and I'm glad that everything sounded good technically for the interview.
Yeah, thank God. So, do you have anything you want to add to the show before we wrap it up here, or do you have any other items that you want to mention?
Well, the one thing I wanted to talk about too was that that kind of went into what they were saying, and you know, it's really hard not to get too apocalyptic, and you know, we see all the you know, how the right has a pretty good historical monopoly on apocalypticism, and you know, we try not to do it too much on the left, but you know, this is a system that is unsustainable, and what we're seeing in economics and government and with oil and the empire, I mean, this is all about sustaining the unsustainable. And I wanted to point out how it was announced yet again that the world food prices hit a record high. And I've been looking at this article from Agence France. They were talking about, the UN Food Agency warned on Thursday, as increased violence in Libya sent jitters to the commodity markets, that they're saying that the oil prices and all the problems that Gaddafi's violence against his people, all the chaos that's causing with all the oil prices is cascading throughout the rest of these commodity markets and food and agriculture, and we're seeing more and more spreading of what kind of causes. I mean, we're kind of seeing a total cycle, kind of a paradox here of how you know, all these food prices and starvation and everything caused a lot of these uprisings, and then now the uprisings and the chaos within the governments and the repression causes more uncertainty, more oil pressure, and, you know, causes more food crises, and this is just going to, you know, create an endless cycle here, and, you know, we're seeing a kind of a death spiral of capitalism both here and abroad. What do you think about that?
Well, I agree, and I think that we are all connected to a system that is, like Derek said earlier, sociopathic or psychopathic. And even though right now we don't have slavery, or at least not the way it used to be, and, you know, women can vote and blacks can vote, and we have some more social benefits, the system hasn't really changed that much from the 1700s or the 1600s when it was kind of set in place through, you know, all these different type of fucked up things that happened back then. And I think the only way we can really change is to get back to local control, get back to growing food, you know, in the region where you live. And for example, like I brought the sack of potatoes the other day, and I looked at the label and it said that they came from Illinois. And so the cost of shipping those potatoes from Illinois to Pennsylvania is, of course, factored into the price. And, you know, as anarchists, we do believe in localized, decentralized solutions. And if you read Derek Jensen and Wazi Absalim, they talk about this a lot, how we need to get back to local control and people, you know, building a sense of community in their local areas, because that's what we've been losing through this so-called globalized world. And we see that right now the system is on the verge of dragging us all off the edge of a cliff. And we have to really find a way to remove the chains and get back to, we don't have to go back to how things were in the Stone Age, but we have to try to realize that the way we're living right now is not sustainable. And we can't.
Yeah, and I think there are many alternatives, and I think the key where we are, too, is that the status quo is making sure to drown out any kind of alternatives, because they are indeed such a threat to the dominant order. Well, I'd like to thank everybody for listening to the Authority Smashing Hour. I guess peace out from Zeno, Ron.
All right, see you all later.
Evolutionary ascent beyond illusion, the events, the sonic has pierced the lotus system, the cerebral spinal axis, divine masses, perceive the highest astral abode, study math of the soul, supernal splendor, universal soul, ascension flow, nectarian, Shiva, Shakti state, self-perceptive, profound planes, the bending sustain, non-dimensional, the born, the element, atma, intelligence, sastric evidence, seeing the prophets, perspectives, introspection, inner perfection, the infinite reflection, gate, gate, param gate, parasam gate, bodhisvaha, gone beyond, altogether gone, merged with the paramatma, fifth vacuum in the Sahasra chakra, blossom sky-like, expanded consciousness, the Maha Mantra invokes superhuman power, supreme secrets of the soul, absorb the whole universe into the body, pierce the Mahanadi, 72,000 astral channels absorbed through the grace of Shakti, Christ consciousness, the quintessence, the service of God called Bhakti, all glories to the assembled devotees, bathing in the ever-fresh ambrosial ocean, with their souls free, we study the source of the established doctrines, immaculate conception, bask in the ever-fessing presence of the Master's blessing. This Son of God told me in a vision that Christ is risen and that all is forgiven. The second coming at hand, accept him in your heart and never deny him. My third eye cries for those that despise him. For the Father and the Son are one. Krishna and Christ, feel the bliss of light. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Rebirth, resurrection, do the research, brethren. The zeitgeist is alive. Lord Krishna wasn't born of a virgin. The Bhagavan, full in six opulence, the supreme person. All beauty, all wealth, all knowledge, all fame, all strength, renunciation. You front and Freemasons deny the Father and the Son. You serve the Antichrist, all you false prophets are done. The meek shall inherit the earth. We shoot the gift with a limitless flow of words, articulation, spreading the rays of the benediction moon. Enrapturing tunes coming from the top of Mount Meru. Jewels that shine from the skylight ocean of mind. Focus on the divine.
Sealed in scrolls of the cellular, self-surrender and love, touch the subtle nerves. What's the word of God, hidden like the divine number on earth and all? Peace to my seekers, searchers, from Muladhara to Sahasra, the outer five chakras. Gotcha, interconnected to multiversal circuitry. Souls to circle, certainly, soldiers grew from birth to bleed. Proceed to the next incarnation awareness. Nothing is ever and nothing is never. Care is a sensor to cure and curing is caring. External, external, serpent power of emerging Aquarian peace and blessings. Shanti, 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 breathing and blessing. Breathing and breathless, heeding the message nirvanic. Climbing the ladder to Shakti cosmic, remove the obstacles. Om Ganesha Gana Padi Om. Got me zoned in lotus of sauna, concocting poems. Attention without tension, now my scar from the soul. Whole and focused in on the starry gates.
Krishna, Christ, conscious, Mahavatars, karma escapes. Heavy wolf physical states to the dark space. Kali Yuga channel through Ayurvedic gardens, brazen with the hearts of sages. Satanam, Ekankar, arm, lega, lega. Sufi caduceus movement through the Sephirothic bark of the Mega. Transfigurate through the ages like martyrs and saviors. You can't harm the charmed artists. We harness assailants and march through the stages of strength. Every exploration, no expectations. Music acoustic like Tibetan levitation. Chant the kundalini up and hover in stasis. Aesthetic direction of ancient sacred. Red rose filling the skull. Build pillars and nadis. Concealed, shielded in body. Reveal clear when you're watching with spiritual eye. Seeing and feeling it rise, no denying. Circle the spine like the staff of Orion. A gentle line, deciphering the science. In the light of the highest eye and eye. Taking flight in a vibrant fight for the righteous. 12 helix beings dreaming in silence. The void is surreal. Virtual particles appeal. 0 point field. Repository of all the glory. The story is real. Born again, born before. 7 doors, 7 seals. 7 keys to breach. Psychic key. The life force we feel.